Do not attempt to change the channel.
All media are extensions of some human faculty.
Is books part of the media?
Media, we don't need it, do we?
Baby, this thing is bigger than all of us.
The media. A lot of you out there probably never even heard of the word.
Media is any form of communication. It can be radio, television, computers.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
You know, we live in the most mediated society in world history. You spend 10 to 12 hours a day with media. And so I think it makes sense to think about, in a sort of systematic and sustained way, our relationship with media.
Good afternoon and welcome to Be the Media. You are listening to, of course, CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. And on this show, we talk about all things media from a local perspective all the way out to a global perspective. And we're hitting all of those things today. We include perspectives of consumers as well as producers of media. All the contributors of Be the Media are faculty, staff, students and friends of the Media Studies Department and Media Research Lab at Vancouver Island University. I'm Marianne Vanderzon, and I'm here with Neil Scobie in the studio.
Good afternoon.
Today we're going to start the show with a live interview with Dominique Rolance. And Dominique is from the bargaining team representing the Faculty Association Union at VIU. And what he's going to do is he's going to give us an update on the strike vote and bargaining process at VIU. And I just want to remind folks that we did have Dominique on the show last week, and basically what we're doing this week is we're going to do an update. And what we did last week is we gave a little bit more of a comprehensive overview to the situation. And so for those that want more information, don't hesitate to check this out. You can access it by downloading the podcast from last week. And so I will mention, too, that the podcast is available. Just go to chly.ca, go to the podcasts link, and there you'll find Be the Media on the list, and you'll get more information there.
Next up, Vancouver Island University Digital Media Studies student Carrie Ann Wagner joins us with a monologue where she examines the question, has our current use of technology, specifically media, influenced public movements to create effective change in our society?
Then we're going to continue the show with a piece from another digital media studies student, David Wu, and he's going to give us a short review on what the best headphones are to buy for when you're listening to music on your iPod.
After that, VIU instructor Alana Williams brings us the next installment of Television Through This Mother's Lens, focusing today on TV and its effects on babies and toddlers. Once again, don't forget to check out our podcast. Go to chly.ca. And also, we invite you to email us at bethemedia@viu.ca.
Remember, too, you can contact us by phone here on the air, 740-1017. We would love to hear from you. Any comments, any feedback, all is welcome. Okay, let's jump in. I'd like to welcome Dominique Rolance back to the studio. I'll just let folks know that Dr. Rolance has been a faculty member at VIU since 1983. He teaches computer science. He's also been the chair of the Faculty Association's negotiating committee for much of the past 20 years, and he's currently the chief steward for the Faculty Association. Welcome back, Dominique.
Thanks for having me here today.
It's a pleasure. So, as I mentioned earlier, you were here last week and you gave us an overview of the strike, of the bargaining situation. And so we've asked you in for an update. So what is the present situation?
Yeah, so as of last Thursday, the audience may remember that we talked about having a strike deadline of March 4th at 9 a.m. And the good news here is that there is no strike on for March 4th. The bad news is that it may still happen on the 9th of March.
And that's next Thursday.
Thursday, yes. And so what's led to that is, and I also reported this last week, is we were scheduled to have bargaining later in the day. And so after I left the studio last week, it was to go up to do some bargaining. And unfortunately, the results of the bargaining on the Thursday, we ended up speaking maybe for 40 minutes or so with the employer. They indicated they had to go off and make some phone calls and check into things. And that we would get together on the 25th and meet. They met with us on the 25th. They seemed to backpedal on some of the things that they were talking about on the 24th. And then at about 2 o'clock, we were given an application from the employer to appoint a mediator pursuant to the labor code. And the effect of that was that our ability to go on strike was delayed. The law says we're not allowed to go on strike until 20 or 48 hours after the mediator books out. We then spent much of the weekend and Monday trying to identify mediation dates with the mediator. And eventually, the earliest date we could get for mediation was the next Monday, the 7th of March. And the I may have said the strike deadline was March 9th. I meant March 10th. It's the Thursday, March 10th. So our earliest date for mediation is Monday. And while there is some chance that mediation will be successful and bring the parties together, I'm not completely convinced that's going to happen. Interestingly, the communications, there seems to be a bit of a communications war, so this is a good show, actually, good content for this show. We've seen emails from the employer to students and to other employees, and those emails talk about, you know, there can be no strike as long as there's a mediator in place. And they're not actually saying, we're hopeful that the mediator will bring the parties together to come up with a resolution to the issues. So interestingly, their whole media communication, their communications with the general sort of university public has been about preventing the strike, not about right. solving the problems. And as the audience may remember, I mean, our biggest issue is the layoffs issue. And the reason it's our biggest issue is we had huge wait lists last term. We had huge wait lists this term. People were stranded without courses because we've already experienced some cuts, and they want to do more. And we think that the university is supposed to be there to offer students the sections of the courses they need. Mm-hmm. And so that's what this is about. I'm hopeful that the employer is going to change its mind. Maybe the mediator will help with that. But given their motivation for bringing in the mediator, I'm really not that optimistic.
Well, you mentioned, too, last week that the sociology department, for example, they had 12 courses cut. Is that right? Was it 12?
The proposal is 12 to 15 sections cut from the sociology department.
And then that would prevent sociology students from completing either a major or a minor.
Yeah, it would be the end of the degree for sure.
Yeah. And so, and at the top of the hour, folks may have heard that there's a protest scheduled for today, actually, in front of the library, and it's being initiated by the sociology students because of those concerns, because, well, of course, they want to be able to finish their degrees. So for folks that are interested, that's happening today from 2 to 4. Interesting. So you are meeting with the mediator on Monday. Are there additional dates set?
We have Monday and Tuesday set for mediation. Now, if it looks like the talks are actually being somewhat fruitful, that the employer has come to bargain in good faith, and I would submit that they have not done that to date. But if they're there to bargain in good faith, or if Grant MacArthur, the mediator, convinces them to start bargaining in good faith, we have another date set for the Tuesday, and hopefully we'll be able to come to an agreement. If, however, bargaining goes as I expect, if it goes like it's gone for the past month and a half or 2 months that we've seen, then we'll be asking the mediator to book out on Monday, and we'll be going out on strike on Thursday.
Okay, so that is the situation then. And so everything is dependent on how things go on Monday.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And that decision will be made after Monday, not after Tuesday.
It'll be made on Monday. If there's progress being made on Monday, then we'll be looking to try and conclude negotiations on Tuesday. But the only days we have with the mediator are Monday and Tuesday. So either we'll have it all sorted out by the end of the day on Tuesday, or alternatively, we'll be on strike by the end of the week.
Okay. Well, not the most fabulous news.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, well, what can you do? Nevertheless, it's good to have the update. Thank you for coming in and giving that to us. Is there anything else that is pertinent to share that hasn't been mentioned yet?
Interestingly, there has been some student activity, some student communication. Obviously, the students are concerned as much as we are about the cuts to education at Vancouver Island University, and so the students may have an interest in making sure that that information makes its way to the employer, that they're concerned too about their education, and that it's important to make sure these courses are offered in the fall and spring of next year. So this no layoffs language is about protecting the students.
Right. Yeah, and then that's exactly right, because it keeps the courses in place, it keeps all the sections in place, it allows people to complete degrees in a timely manner.
Absolutely.
Everything that follows.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much, Dominique Rolance.
Thanks. Thanks.
It was Joe Hill's best song. Well, we almost missed the damn thing. Chorus is, there is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. I'll teach you the chorus. There is power, there is power. Oh, would you have freedom from wage slavery and come join the grand industrial band? Oh, would you from misery and hunger be free? Come on, do you share land to hand? There is power, there is power. In heaven to fly and start here with a rag on your back. But there is power, there is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand. That's a power that must rule in every land. One industrial union grand. Oh, if you like sluggers to beat in your head, don't organize all union despise. If you want nothing before you are dead, shake hands with your boss and look wise. But there is power in a band of working folks when we stand hand in hand.
Welcome back to Be the Media. That was Utah Phillips with There's Power in the Union. Again, special thanks to Dominique Rolance for the strike update.
Next up, we have digital media studies student Carrie Ann Wagner. And Carrie Ann is joining us here live in the studio. And again, she's examining the question, has our current use of technology, specifically media, influenced public movements in order to create effective change in our society? Carrie Ann, welcome.
Thank you. As a mature student in the digital media studies program at VIU, I have been fascinated in how technology is growing and changing, and the way we as a society have grown to accept new forms of distributing information and connecting with each other. I have just recently turned 41. My daughter is going to be a mother, and in 2012, I am going to graduate university with a digital media studies degree. Change is inevitable. Some you have no control over, and some change you make happen on your own. So the question I pose to answer here today is, how has our current use of technology, specifically media, influenced public movements to create effective change in our society? As a society, our social networking often starts with people feeling connected by using the same outlets, such as online games, chat rooms, or comments to written articles, blogs, or items shared on our personal pages of social network sites, such as Facebook. Today's social networking has opened many doors, connecting individuals into a group of like-minded people ready to band together, stand up, and speak out for what they believe in. The internet has provided us with a branching to help interact with each other and to encourage each other. It also spurs information and knowledge about community, concerns that need our attention, and active response locally. But to be active in a purpose doesn't always mean sit-ins, protests, and boycotts. Malcolm Gladwell, author of The Tipping Point, believed in order to create one contagious movement, you often have to create many small movements first. When I first watched the news coverage of the uprising in Egypt, I wondered, in what seemed to me a short amount of time, how did so many people collectively come to stand together on the same issue? It reminded me of a flash mob. What is a flash mob? The term flash mob, according to Wikipedia, and coined in 2003, is to denote a group of people who assemble suddenly in a public place. They perform an unusual and sometimes seemingly pointless act for a brief time, then disperse. This act is often for the purpose of entertainment and/or satire. Now, although this political stand was not for entertainment purposes, the organization started via telecommunications, social media, or viral emails, which provided them with a supportive response from the people. Another organization that uses the benefits of social networking to spur a movement and improve the world is Carrot Mob. Carrot Mob campaigns have produced some positive results in their mission to advance sustainability around the world. It starts with local businesses competing to make social and environmental improvements. Carrot Mob then organizes a group of people, through social networking, to make already required purchases at the winning business location. Through the power of consumer purchasing, Carrot Mob encourages businesses to use the extra revenue from the consumers' campaigning to finance a local way of advancing sustainability. These mobs are only one example, a strong example, of the power a group of people can create. Another way people feel connected and justified is when other people share a similar experience, thought, or belief. Post-Secret, a movement connecting people through emotional and mental turmoil, triumph, life experience, and personal thoughts. This is the place people send secrets to, using a postcard with a visual, descriptive image to accompany the secret written on the card. Secrets include things like the strength to come out, expressions of suicide, regrets of relationships gone wrong, acts against moral beliefs, reassurance they are not alone. As one commenter on the site shares, we're not as alone as it seems. Post-Secret has teamed up with Hopeline to launch I'm Alive in a quick 30 days to be the first virtual crisis center. 100% of the volunteers are trained and certified in crisis intervention. Facebook is, in my belief, the ultimate social network site. This site keeps me connected with my family from Calgary and with my busy friends. I moved to the island 10 years ago, so through pictures and status updates, I get to see my nephews mature to men. My Facebook wall is often hosting a video or news report a friend feels is an important issue that needs large support and more attention. Let's not forget notable causes like Earth Hour Canada or BC Power Smart organizations that have used Facebook to band positive mobs together in one mission. As we have come to learn, the Pan-Arab youth movement was a result of 2 years of Facebook exchange. Personally, I feel the internet has provided me with many more opportunities to stay informed and be proactive in the issues I believe in. My technology experience started with Atari and a second phone line in the house, corded only. Maybe this will give you a moment to consider your first experience with social networking and what its connections has provided you.
Some walls are made of stone, and sometimes we build our own.
And some walls stand for years, and some wash away with tears.
Some walls are lined with gold. Stay safe and cold.
And so-
some walls are built on pride, and some keep the child inside.
And some walls are built on fear that love that goes
back to Be the Media. You're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM here in Nanaimo. That was Tommy Emmanuel with the song Walls. Carrie Ann, welcome back and thank you for your monologue.
Thank you. That was enjoyable.
Good. So Carrie Ann, you chose the song Walls. Why did you choose that song to close off your monologue?
It talks about walls coming down, and I think that part of our interacting and socializing is about connecting with one another and feeling like we don't have a wall, you know, to keep ourselves separated. Mm-hmm. And the only way that we ever, you know, that to make a change is to kind of take that step, and you have to knock a wall down that scares you.
Yeah. Well, and it's true. And, you know, you made a lot of really valid points in your monologue. But, you know, the one that stuck with me is that certainly social networking has had a huge impact on us, how we organize ourselves, how we create community, and how we engage with activism and protest. You know, we see it even with the strike that's happening now.
Definitely. I found in my own thoughts, I think the church used to bring us together as a community, and now we have other options. And at school, the students are constantly talking. We share in our classes. And so the strike is just one new avenue to bring us closer together and be able to talk and be able to share our own thoughts on what's happening now that we know there is discussion and that things are coming together. The students need to be a part of it. They want to have their voice heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Carrie, as far as the social networking goes as a means of reaching out, do you think that ironically it also creates a wall in some sense? Like if we're communicating behind computer screens, then we don't maybe feel, you know, the same sort of human connection that we would if we were to meet somebody face to face?
I believe that, because I don't think that our true selves are able to be on the screen, because we're typing. Whereas when they send it out for us to join together, you're actually there and you're with a group of people, and your personalities have to show and you have to be real. And if you didn't believe in it in the first place, maybe you just wouldn't be there.
Although, on the other side of things, if we think about, you know, for example, in Iran, homophobia is rampant, and for somebody to be out, they risk death. And here is a place, through social networking, through the internet, where actually they can be out in terms of their sexuality and in a relatively safe way. So one could then argue, just to play devil's advocate, that they are more themselves from being in front of a computer in that context.
Right. Very true.
But it's an interesting point that you make, Neil, because I sometimes notice it myself, you know, being on Facebook and other social networking tools, that it's very easy to like something. But sometimes the action or the active presence stops there. And I think on some level people feel like they're involved. But I question a little bit, how do we move from a place of building community online to actually being active in our society?
This was a discussion I had. A friend of mine is a large activist. That's all he wants to do is make sure that he spurs new movements. He likes to share things. And in many of our discussions, I always said, well, what difference could I make as one person? And through those different liking sites, let's say on Facebook, I found that I wasn't the only person who liked it. There were five of my friends that also liked it. So suddenly we started to have a discussion, and then we showed up, and we actually made it to an event together. Sometimes on your own, maybe you don't feel as secure or comfortable in being there. Until you get there, then you meet new people and people like-minded.
Right. So your point is those connections are made in advance, and then that community is already building, and so it creates the potential for people then to go out.
I feel that for myself, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, there's no denying the power that exists with social networking. I just think that people hide behind a computer screen or maybe don't make the extra effort to connect with somebody. I don't think that emailing or even a phone call is the same as talking to somebody face-to-face.
The one thing I find is when you're talking, and I mean, we have emoticons and new ways of showing emotion, but that's the part that I think we're missing when we're talking online. We don't get body language.
No.
We don't get our emotional expressions, so you don't get to see maybe the sorrow in the eyes. They may not say the right words, but maybe the expression is there.
Yeah, I often wonder about that too, if that same depth of connection is there. I wonder if it rests a little bit more superficially on the surface.
I don't think there's any denying it. My interest lays in, like, where does this take us? Like, how will it affect us? You know, like, growing up around a television, I just took TV for granted. And it's only as an adult that I'm realizing the extreme effects, both positive and negative, it's had on my life. And I'm interested to see, you know, what Blackberries and Facebook and all sorts of, you know, electronic communication is going to have long term, you know, just as people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right now I'm teaching a course online. It's a history of communication course, and we had a very similar discussion online, but in the context of forums, so everything's typed. And the question was basically, is the art of conversation important? So this idea of connecting at a deeper level. And one of the things that I found really interesting in the responses is you could, in large part, you could tell people's ages from what their responses were. And some of the folks that were younger, the comments surprised me, because some of them said straight out that they didn't have any interest in having conversations with greater depth. It was not an interest that they had, and they were quite happy in having more multiple layers of connection and reaching out to many more people and many more topics of information. But they didn't feel like they were missing out on anything, and they didn't feel like they wanted to put the time there.
I think it comes down to the technology available at hand. My 12-year-old son, he has a cell phone. I'm a little embarrassed to say, but you know, if it's normal to communicate by texting or on Facebook, if that is the social norm that you grow up in, then I could see that some of your students, Marion, might actually just grow accustomed to that. You know, as a child of the 70s, I was accustomed to the telephone. I mean, it was older than me, so it's just there. But, you know, my dad grew up in 1920s Saskatchewan, so they didn't have a telephone. And so to communicate was to go outside and to play. And he, you know, it's just a different time. And going back to my other comment was, I'd like to see what the long-term effects are on just as humans, just with electronic communication.
You don't think that as we've moved along, because, I mean, the internet was almost like, and games online were a new fad. So, you know, when you get into a new fad, you kind of go into it and you get overwhelmed. You're just totally consumed by it. And then you kind of, okay, it's old now. And we're starting to slowly come out again and start to enjoy outside. There's a lot of different active movements in commercials are showing different ways to spur children along to get them outside again. The one thing when you were saying about your son having a cell phone, I found communicating with my daughter when she was younger through texting calmed me. At least I had constant contact with her, yeah, no matter where she was. But that was then.
Well, certainly technology is moving at a much more rapid pace than it ever has historically. So, you know, Neil, to your comment of what are the effects of this and how does it change the way that we build society and grow society, it's hard to know because the speed is just, it's really ramped up more than any other time in history. Carrie Ann, thank you so much for joining us. Once again, folks, this was Carrie Ann Wagner, a digital media studies student from VIU University. And next up, we have David Wu. And David Wu is giving us a short review on what headphones to buy for your iPod.
Hello, everyone. This is David Wu. I'm a digital media student from VIU. Today, I'm here to talk about how to choose the best headphone for your iPod. Before you even think about what type of headphones that you want to purchase, the first question that comes to mind is, which music genres that you always listen to? It is quite important to know there are specific headphones made for specific music genres. Once you decide the music genres, you have to figure out what level of frequency you love the most. Even for some of the rock fans, prefer lower frequency headphones. Moreover, frequency is not the only thing that you have to be aware of. Impedance and sensitivity is also considerable. The higher number of impedance is, then the harder it is to run in an iPod. In this case, headphone amplifier is necessary for high frequency headphones. The proper number of impedance range for iPod is from 14 to 17. The proper sensitivity range for iPod is from 105 to 110. The higher number of sensitivity means it is much more easier to run on iPod. After all, we can start to look at different type of headphones and think about how much is the reasonable price to pay for these headphones. Here are the top 5 headphones that I think is the best for your iPod. Let's start with number 5, the Grandeur SR60i. The SR60i is an open-ear cup headphone with no isolation from outside noise. However, this is the best headphone for the rock fans. Personally, I only use this headphone to listen all the rock music. If you get this headphone, you will find that the quality and the design are well built. Especially the cable is much thicker than the usual ones. Also, this headphone is not heavy at all, so it is proper weight to use for iPod. The only bad thing about this headphone is that people who are nearby might hear while you are listening, especially in a quiet environment. The price for this headphone is about $110. The number 4 is the Bose on-ear headphone. The Bose OE provides perfect compact design, even though the cable itself is quite thin. The headphone itself still provides incredible bass quality. Personally, I think this headphone is perfect for listening pop and hip-hop music. The price for this headphone is about $250. Number 3 is also my personal daily use, the Monster Beats by Dr. Dre Tour in-ear headphone. This headphone provides perfect noise canceling and super high quality sound. The best thing I love about this headphone is the flat red cable that never gets tangled. I also recommend this headphone is perfect for runners because they won't have to worry about the headphones that will fall off. the price for this headphone is about $180. Number two, the Ultimate Ears Super 5.5 Pro. The UE Super 5.5 Pro is an in-ear headphone. This headphone provides great noise isolation. Personally, I think this headphone is particularly for jazz and blues music. The price for this headphone is about $200. And finally, the top one is the Edmonic ER6i. This headphone not only provides good noise isolation, it provides awesome clarity and detailed sound quality. Personally, I use this headphone to listen to vocal music. The price for this headphone is about $120. This headphone's review is specially for iPod. I believe the best headphone type for all portable audio devices is still the in-ear type, since it's the most portable ones can fit right into your pocket. So there. These are the top 5 headphones review for your iPod. Thanks for listening.
To Be the Media, and a special thanks again to David Wu for his piece on headphones. We just heard The Bear That Wasn't and headphones. Next up, we bring you Alana Williams and her next installment of Television Through This Mother's Lens. Today's focus is TV and its effects on babies and toddlers.
Hello, this is Alana Williams. I'm a faculty member in the Media Studies Department at Vancouver Island University, and I have a confession to make. I absolutely love television. But as great as television can be sometimes, it can also be an issue, particularly when children come into the picture. I know from my own firsthand experience and from being a media professor that television images can have a major impact on a growing brain. And because I am also a mother of 3 girls who range in age from 12 years old to less than a year, I tend to be quite picky about what I allow my kids to watch, and I am also careful about what I watch when they are around. But I was surprised to find out recently that I have been doing it wrong, because when my kids were very young, I let them watch TV. I know that being a mom means that I'm going to experience guilt for the myriad of ways that I've wronged my children, but I didn't expect that television viewing would be one of them. So in this show, I am turning this mother's lens to television for babies and very small children. Having children is one of the most significant events that can really alter the way someone lives their life, and this definitely applied to my situation. Before I had kids, I was very active outside of the home, working, playing soccer, hanging out with friends. I rarely watched TV because really, I wasn't home enough to get into any program enough to care about whether I watched it from week to week. But that all changed when my first daughter was born more than 12 years ago. Isolation and loneliness were my biggest challenges when I became a new mom and moved from the working world into the home world. And it was television that was the antidote. During the first 3 months of my daughter's life, I can vividly recall sitting on the couch while she nursed for what seemed like hours on end, and I became very familiar with what show was on what channel at what time. After a while, certain TV personalities even felt like my new BFFs. Oprah and I never got along very well, but I really clicked with the Canadians. There was Dan Matheson and Valerie Pringle, who brightened up my AM as they informed me about the happenings across Canada. And Marilyn Dennis helped me learn about home improvement projects and shared the latest trends in fashion and culinary worlds on her show CityLine. Because my daughter was just a small baby, I didn't think at the time that there would be any negative impacts on her if the television was on during the day, and I would often keep it on because it kept me company. But the transition from when she was vaguely aware of the television to when she would actively pay attention to it took place so gradually that we weren't even aware of it happening until one day when she was 4 months old. My daughter's dad was holding her while he surfed through the channels trying to find something to watch. And he came across a program called The Teletubbies. He noticed that our daughter perked up and stared at the TV when it came on, so he kept it on that channel for a while, and she watched intently the whole time. I'm not sure if any of you remember The Teletubbies. It aired on PBS, but was developed by the BBC and was geared towards very small children aged 1 to 4. You may remember that the Teletubbies was a source of some minor controversy in 1999 after the American cleric Jerry Falwell accused one of the characters, named Tinky Winky, of being a homosexual role model for children. Apparently Falwell came to this conclusion because Tinky Winky wore purple and had a triangular-shaped antenna on its head. The uproar didn't last long because, frankly, it was a ridiculous claim. And the Teletubbies went on to earn critical and commercial success, and my daughter went on to become a very big fan of the show. Of course, we facilitated her watching the Teletubbies because we put it on for her once in a while. And I would say that from the time she was about 5 months on, she probably watched the half-hour show, on average, about 3 or 4 times a week. So then by the time she was a year old, the Teletubbies had become quite a big part of her life. She had stuffies of each of the tubbies and other Teletubby-themed merchandise, such as a hat, scarf, mittens, and slippers, which she loved dearly. We were rather tickled by her attachment to the Teletubbies, and it had some nice fringe benefits. The theme song was soothing to her, and we would sing it very loudly to calm her down on the drive home after daycare when she would be cranky and tired. And after all these years, I can still sing it just as I did back then. When the Teletubbies was on, it provided a space in the day when I could get some laundry or dishes done, because I knew she would be content. She wouldn't necessarily just sit and watch it, she would move around, but it kept her engaged and entertained. And there was one day when the Teletubbies saved me completely. My daughter was about 11 months old, and I came down with one of the worst flus that I've ever had. I could barely take care of myself, never mind a baby, because I couldn't get off the couch. That whole day, I only moved to get her food, to change her diaper, or to lay her down for a nap. I certainly didn't play with her, or hold her, or otherwise entertain her. But the Teletubbies did. We had bought a VHS that contained several of the episodes, and I pretty much played it over and over, and that is what enabled me to survive that terrible day. Fast forward now 11 years, and I am once again in a very similar position as I was back then, at home with a new baby. There seems to be a lot more information available for new parents than there was back when I first did it. And since advice for parents of newborns is always changing, I've done quite a bit of reading about how to care for my baby. As well, because I've been doing this show, it's made me reflect on my parenting decisions around television, and I was curious if the experts' recommendations on children and television lined up with my approach. So I went to the internet to see what they had to say about it, and what I found kind of surprised me. I came across a newspaper article from the CanWest News Service dated October of 2009, reporting that the Canadian Pediatric Society was going to change their position on television for the under 2 crowd, from some limited viewing to none at all. This new guideline would follow the American Academy of Pediatrics guideline, which recommended in 1999 and again affirmed in 2001 that parents should not allow children under 2 years of age to watch any television at all. Apparently, they don't agree that small children should watch shows like the Teletubbies, even if these television shows are specifically geared towards this young age group and claim to have educational benefits. It was a bit of a shocker for me to find out that my approach was quite different than what was being recommended by the health authorities, and so I dug a little deeper into this because I was curious as to the AAP's reasoning behind the no television under 2 years recommendation. I read through the policy document on the Academy's website, and in it they cite a lot of truly worrisome facts about the negative effects on children of excessive screen time, which includes screens other than the television, like computers and gaming consoles. The part of the policy statement that pertains to television viewing for the very small child didn't actually address any specific negative impacts for this age group if they watch TV. But instead, it talks about how the very important social, emotional, and cognitive functions are best learned through interactions with real people and not from a television show. If you're interested in reading the statement, the policy is titled Media Education and can be found on the American Academy of Pediatrics website at www.aap.org. I found that after I read this policy, it didn't help me understand their position better. And it actually left me feeling a bit annoyed. It seems to me that the AAP has so strongly positioned itself against television viewing for small children because they believe that parents or caregivers will substitute television viewing for one-on-one interaction. While this may be the case for some caregivers out there, this certainly isn't the case for most. I believe that parents will do what is best for their children if they are taught how to be the best parents they can be and told why they need to make certain decisions, such as limiting the amount of television and increasing the positive interactions that they have with their kids, such as singing, talking, and playing, particularly with babies and small children. Perhaps the AAP doesn't go to this place in their policy statement because it is designed for a pediatrician audience who then will disseminate and interpret this information for parents. But it doesn't make this clear on their website, and the policy statement is available to anyone with an internet connection. I decided to see if the Canadian Pediatric Society had any information about this on their website. And from what I found, it doesn't appear as if they have formally gotten behind the no TV for under 2 position of the AAP. Their statement, which is available on their website at www.cps.ca, it suggests that time in front of the TV should be limited to less than 1 or 2 hours per day for all kids. This didn't jive with the article I read. So I decided to ask my local public health nurse, because I've found that the public health office is a great source of information about parenting. I spoke with one of the public health nurses there, and she confirmed that there isn't an official position against all TV viewing for very small children, but rather that parents should not be fooled by misleading marketing of some TV shows or DVDs that claim they will make small kids smarter if they watch their shows. She acknowledged that there are times when it makes sense that caregivers may have small kids watch TV. She mentioned illness or having to get a household chore done, which connected very much with my own experience. Phew. So it would seem that their position is in line with what I have been doing, which I think is a more common sense approach than to completely forbid any watching of television at all. I hope that Canadian pediatricians stay with this position and continue to educate and support all caregivers who have the very challenging task of spending most of the day with people under the age of 2 while trying to keep a house as well. It's not an easy task, and for me, having the TV on once in a while is a very big help. And that's how I see television for the very young.
Thank you.
Arts and Humanities Colloquium is coming this spring to VIU. Join us for free and engaged presentations on a variety of topics. On March 4th at VIU's Malaspina Theater, Ross Dupre, Theater Department, presents History on Stage, Transforming History into Relevant, Entertaining Musical Theater. On April 1st at VIU's Library, join Dr. Marnie Stanley, Department of Women's Studies and Department of English, as she presents Graphic Matters, Women Making Comics. Join us on these Friday mornings for an intellectually engaging series, the Arts and Humanities Colloquium. All are welcome. For more information, contact Dr. Helen Brown at helen.brown@viu.ca. The Arts and Humanities Colloquium, this spring at VIU.
And welcome back to Be the Media, folks. So again, just remember that Arts and Humanities Colloquium, the talk is tomorrow at 10 a.m. And so that song, that last song we heard was The Ronettes, Be My Baby. And next up, we're going to finish the show off with Paparazzi Trigger Finger. And that's the next installment by Kevin Mazutenik. And I'll also take this opportunity to thank our many guests and contributors today on Be the Media. Dominique Rolance, Carrie-Anne Wagner, David Wu, Kevin Mazutenik, Neil Scobie, of course, and I'm Marian Vanderzon. Once again, you're listening to CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. I encourage you to contact us for any feedback or story ideas, bethemedia@viu.ca. You can listen to the podcast, just go to chly.ca and you'll find the podcast link and you can listen to the podcast as many times as your ears desire. Here we go, Kevin Mazutenik, Paparazzi Trigger Finger.
I'm finding it hard to muster the energy as this familial turd was deposited a little too close to the nest.
Paparazzi Trigger Finger.
I'm Kevin Mazutenik, and welcome to Paparazzi Trigger Finger. At the sound of the turning page, we will begin a new fiction.
The Sacred Cowgirl, page 66. Technique. I prefer the orbital. It's far superior. Of course, it had to be. Personally, I don't care which one a person tries. I just have yet to find one that...
The elephant. It is the only one that does not produce this effect you speak of.
Au contraire, my good man.
Pardon?
Same.
Ludicrous.
It's the same. Marie, would you be so kind as to throw me one of those mandarins, s'il vous plaît? Marie tries to do her best to ignore this growing debate, praying that it will peter out quickly without...
Marie!
Snap, snap go the fingers. And as they do, you can hear the saline gaze shatter from each of her eyes and burst outward in a stream of crystal shards aimed right for the heart of her tactless fiancé. Prior to the razored arrival at the destined target, Claude is blunted head-on by one of those mandarins, causing him to literally bite his tongue, nearly severing the styloglossus and forcing him to spit out his pride instead of swallowing it. Lenore swipes the orange out of the air in front of Claude's tear-filled peepers. Okay, boys. The only way you can peel a mandarin orange in a single piece without resulting in a shape similar to your manhood is via a little method I like to refer to as the yin and yang. And although the masculine latter of the two may, at your most adolescent levels, phonetically remind you of male genitalia, you will see that the passive feminine force will restore a balance and harmony to your egos and to the remainder of our evening. The demonstration would continue right through the final preparations for the dinner, right up until the cilantro was sprinkled down into the wells of Olive's extra virgin oil. Godel, page 106. I am deeply saddened to hear of your cousin Louis's latest entrepreneurial bumble. Second cousin, your father's fault. Or shall I say, side. Unfortunately, I have been assigned with the task of informing extended family members of his failed foray and subsequent deterioration of mental well-being. Normally, I would be fourth or fifth in line to point and jeer at the follies of a true imbecile, but I'm finding it hard to muster the energy as this familial turd was deposited a little too close to the nest. Spurred on by a late-night early morning viewing of White Wilderness, the archaic Disney documentary, Lewis immediately liquidated all assets within his reach. This may be terrible to say, but one cannot help but to be thankful that he managed to loose himself of his right arm during his stint at Uncle Wallace's woodmill. Otherwise, had he two arms, the entire family fortune may have been invested in the Lemmings' Last Leg alehouse. Yes, you are reading it correctly. An alehouse. Not that such a business venture fails to hold significant potential when placed in capable hands. Ah, there it is again. Pluralized. As it should be. As it should be. Sadly, void of any relevant experience, the main motivation behind this enterprise was not sparked by the promise of profit. Rather, it had a queer alignment to his political dietary habits. How we have all been so tolerant of his irksome fruitarian practices, I cannot even begin to imagine. Due to Lewis's laissez-faire attitude towards, let's just be frank, towards absolutely every facet of his life, it has been incredibly difficult to support him through some of the more glaring contradictions. Current case in point, those vile little vermin his speakeasy was named after. Lewis believed that the Lemmings, poor pathetic little beasties, and their supposed suicidal tendencies would provide a unique, viable protein source for the flesh-deprived fruitarian fell.
Thank you for tuning in, and once again, this is Kevin Mazatenik from Paparazzi Trigger Finger.
Be the Media is brought to you by the Media Studies Department and the Media Research Lab at VIU.
How does that grab you?